The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. We have a small but intimate group. So in the truest sense of the title of this panel, we'll hopefully get into a real dialogue about human rights issues 6 years after 9/11. Let me begin by introducing myself. My name is Raj Chopra.
Would you use the microphone, please? It's hard to understand you.
Excuse my voice, I still try to get over a very strong cold, so I'm going to keep my remarks brief in order to also facilitate the dialogue afterwards. But the panel today, at least the topic for today, was human rights after 9/11. And it's an interesting topic, considering that a lot of people probably feel that human rights was impacted adversely after 9/11 as a consequence of the attack upon the United States. But many other countries were impacted as well, not only through terrorist just a reflection of the anxiety that created also the United States and then, of course, in the Western world, and all the consequences and consequences. And it's interesting in the sense that we turn like not just the United States, but I think every country there is suffering a terrorist attack. Turns inward first in analyzing what went wrong and what can I do immediately to fix that problem, and then see who can I join for the problem. And the United States was nothing. And the United States went through a process of evaluating how he determined threats. And the process took several decades originally, where he got to assess conflicts and problems through states that sponsored terrorists. In the 90s, he started to shift to a process of targeting the groups that actually conducted these terrorist acts. But 9/11 brought in even more more into a local manner, and it identified not just general groups, but particular groups and particular individuals. To target particular individuals, created then the necessity to create, what is the perception of creating, new ways to attack those problems in terms of the threat that the country was perceived to be experiencing after the attacks, but our experience has been seen in other countries as well. So what happened? You started seeing legislation that focused on how to ascertain the threat at the individual level. So you start to see legislation that created the conflict in terms of the democracy, our democracy in the United States, but democracy in general. How to put into balance our need to have a more secure border exportation. And at the same time, create a balance where the individual rights of the people are not infringed upon. How do I ascertain who is a military threat, but at the same time not deprive you of your right to travel around the country or to travel to other countries? And that balance is the struggle that we are facing to this day. Now, that process from looking domestically, you can say that a good example of legislation that domestically rest of speech was the Patriot Act, which basically gave the authority to the federal government to look into several areas that before U.S. citizens thought they were of personal nature and the government had no authority to go into. To how he projected internationally those spiritual anxieties with the apprehension of what was there classified as military combatants or non-combatants, and then the creation of the military tribunals, and the process where information could be gathered and be useful in quasi-judicial systems, whether they were or not according to strict domestic U.S. law at the time of the creation of the law. Basically, it's a new system. It's created a new legal system that everybody's still scratching their heads in terms of what we have to do. Even by the adoption of last year of the military tribunals, there was a lot of debate in terms of what was feasible under international law. Now, every process where you have a dramatic change in the political system caused by a tragic event or a terrorist act like 9/11, you have a swing where security concerns are have priority over other considerations. After the passage of time, you see that people are assessing different aspects of those security measures. Not so much because the threat is gone, but the aspects, the reassertion of the individual rights and the civil rights of the people that decide. You can see, in a way, because of the reaction to the security attack, in a way, you can see it on the past couple of weeks, all this controversy that you're seeing regarding the authority of the federal government to ask for information without notifying the person investigating that their personal data is collected. And that's being right now under review and being considered, there's legislation being considered on how to scale back a little bit all those emergency powers that were granted to the federal government in order to investigate potential threats to the security of the country. But basically, what we are really doing is we are reasserting the individual rights of the people. Another consequence of the reassessing period that we're experiencing right now, and see it also in the military tribunal. Right now, for some new legislation that we use in the House side and the Senate to scale back or modify the military tribunal set, where one, the major, one of the most important things is that it recognizes all the Geneva conventions without any caveats, which is argued that that's what was approved last year. And in terms of individual rights, the right to have his corpus is going to be reinstated for all these people that are being accused of committing acts against the United States for terrorism. I would say that we are in a process of reassessing how far individual liberties have to be put into a straitjacket, to use some sort of a description, in order to protect the general welfare of the entire country. The balance, of course, whether security or individual liberties, is always going to be in the forefront of the thing. Now, the issue is, if you live in a democratic society, what is the more important principle or value? And that's an ongoing debate. Whether our situation in the United States has created a situation similar in other European countries is debatable, but several countries have implemented some treaty measures, and the individual rights in those countries have been affected by those measures. If we are reassessing the situation here, would that assessment also take place in other countries? But the fact is, that the threat that created all these situations of civil liberties is still out there. Now, whether another incident is going to retrench all those anxieties into more strict laws, stricter laws to civil liberties, is going to be more in terms of well, the citizenship is willing to accept those, I guess, the cost of it. Probably accept to some points right now. So I'm going to stop right here.
I follow Thomas exactly. CIA reported that Saddam Hussein had ties to the Al-Qaeda or the Boko Haram members, and that this statement was rejected by the government himself because his perspective of Saddam Hussein was an enemy to the ties because he was a secular government. And after the war, a few papers made a few mistakes to the beach. The first mistake was that the college course to take inside of love, they did not close the book. We actually checkers to get inside the country. And at least the first year, all the car bombers and all the suicide bombers, they were all born fighters and got to the Russians, at least for the first year. Then comes the second stage, which is the result of the army. So there was people without jobs, without weapons, and there, the government of the European Union was, so they become a tendency target for the recruitment of the rebels. The reasons of the war. The President Bush said that, I hope there is no question that Saddam Hussein had a target out. And then after the war, he said, quote, we had no evidence that Saddam Hussein had involved with Saddam Hussein. Of course, we all know evidence of such things. There was nothing to supply Iraq to that terrorism, which is absolutely a terrorist-free country. But since the war, I'm going to talk about the new terrorist groups in Iraq, and since the war, we had, I'm just going to take example of what we had, because we had a national that I'm going to talk about. The network is exactly what the terrorist groups are basically militias with the government that we have recently. So, at the beginning of the talk about the United Army, which is basically an extremist Shia groups, they have a strong ties to Iran. And they're basically very far from the defense to the surface of the surface and the members of the governments for people for the military from the British government. Their major discussion under the Spanish Rhine is they start basically killing people based on their identity or the nationality you are safe or you are. But basically you have to tell them. Depends on how the rest of the people are shifting. This is how they start killing people. Then the other group is practically the UDA, which is they change the name of the Iraq. If they begin with the same thing, they change the name of the Iraq into something like that, which is basically 888 and about. I think when you talk about the power, it basically becomes mostly all about beheading. Soldiers, American soldiers, or any foreign contractors, or any kind of like idiots. He was built across the earth now and Air Force Raid. They had the Arabs, the Arabs and Kurds were actually supporting the Islamic Iraqi country. Then we have Al-Qaeda, which is captured on most of the according to the website that works. We have the security forces of that explosion that actually happened in Iraq. Then we have the Panther Brigade. Seriously, this is my favorite. They invented the music through their Shia group, and they are supported by the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and they are the major coalition, Shia coalition within the government. The major person in the Al-Qaeda is the previous Ministry of Interior, Minister of Interior, sorry. He invented the disintegral of the Soviet Union. The target is usually the students. Which is, it was basically, I think, Iran who was supported with, let's say, sometimes to care of them, to work on the meetings with Iran. They left Iran like after the second publication in 1972, and they stayed in Iraq since then. But of course, they also left the country, but I don't think so. Then, finally, you have the guy in Saddam. They're basically taking care of the young people, mostly orphans, or from the poor kids, and train them into being Mexican killers. Actually, they are there because they don't perform them after the war. So, that you have to do the new government's offers to cooperate with the new government. I decided to be very brief, but I love the question and answer, because then I decided not to put the suggestion for the solutions, because if I do have any solution for the situation in Iraq, I will shoot for at least I should be the new prime minister.
So that the kind of process for finance depending on
possible other sense. Sorry.
Government is proposing a new amendment for the constitution so as to remove the judges away from supervising the petition. Since September 11, some states have seen the struggle against terrorism as a new sign of war against the global terrorist network, which fired in the latest results. Other states, like Kent, have viewed this struggle as not an entirely new phenomenon, which requires international cooperation in law enforcement, intelligence gathering, and transportation and the like. However, it is important that acts of terrorism not to be conflated with acts of war. For example, attacks against civilians, the taking of hostage, the seizure and destruction of civilians, the one that presents my colleague was talking about, they are all accepted by international community to be forms of terrorism. If these acts are committed during armed conflict, they may constitute war crimes. But if they are committed during peacetime, they certainly do not constitute war crimes, but their perpetrators should not be labeled, tried, or targeted as combatants. Such situations are governed not only by international humanitarian law, but by international human rights law, domestic law, and perhaps international the ICJ, in its advisory opinion regarding the construction of a wall in occupied Palestinian territories, stated that the protection offered by human rights conventions does not cease in case of armed conflict. Both of the Environmental Commission and the Human Rights Commission have the same view as the ICJ. Others said the enjoyment of human rights is the definition of terrorism. Among 12 international conventions, only one defined terrorism, which is the International Convention for the Supervision of the Financing of Terrorism, which is mentioned. It defines it only for the purpose of that treaty, so still needs more clear definition. However, many states have enacted laws that are broader than this definition. Other states, like Egypt, have adopted the criminal law by increasing the penalty of existing crimes such as murder when committed with terrorist intent. Sometimes there are about the aforementioned crimes are committed with intent, with a terrorist intent, which are going to aggravate the penalty to be carried by punishment. So, what happened to the right to liberty and security and right to a fair trial? Since September 11 attacks, terrorist suspects have been detained for prolonging a period without contact with lawyers and other persons and without access to court. Some detainees have been subjected to torture and death treatment. The practices are prohibited under the National Human Rights Law. What happened to children? We were not aware of all of that. Since September 11, children have been subject to be kept in the same facilities as adults and have been the victims of mistreatment, intimidation by police dogs, sexual abuse. Some of them have been denied contact with legal counsel, family, council officials, as well as the right to challenge their openness of their detention before a court. The protection of the rights of a child does not include interrogation laws. That means we can never deprive children from this protection. Let's look at the military tribunal. Are they acceptable, affiliated to civilian courts or not? Some persons described as enemy or unprotected have been found over for trial before the military commissions that have been decided as failing to satisfy minimum fair trial standards. It is important to emphasize that fundamental due process protections are
God not only to prisoner for Syrians, but also for some village to happen, who are denied protection on a dead or forced man of religion. The fact is that the food is a violation of the principle of non-retroactivity, of dependent restrictions on access to witnesses and evidence, employment of national security considerations that are not a part of criminal trials before civilian courts. Also, since in 2011, many reports regarding tortures, it's expressed concern about methods employed by some states to confront terrorism, seek to undermine the prohibition of torture for cruel and human degrading treatment. These concerns include interrogation technique, police information, the use of evidence of torture, taking places. Mention that the legislation encouraged immigration authority to detect certain persons to the very country that's likely to torture them. These measures are incompatible with the absolute prohibition of torture in the four Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols. What time is the principle of non-refoulement? Since September 11, some states expedited, expelled, deported, or transferred foreigners, some of them assigned seekers suspected of terrorism to the country of origin, where they are allegedly faced a risk of torture or being beaten. They say that they are depending on diplomatic assurance, but the mere fact that such assurance are sought is a tacit admission of defending state that there is a risk of torture for their treatment. And what happened to the right of property? The Security Council and the UN organization of 2011 have taken measures to identify and increase assets that may be used to facilitate the commission of terrorist acts. We all agree that seizing assets of terrorist persons are appropriate and necessary to combat terrorism. Since we have no definition for terrorism, so states does not only draw up such lists in order, but commonly expect to provide a judicial review and right to appeal to commission. What happened to the right of privacy? Many states have increased the significance of and information gathering on terrorist aspects to wiretapping sexual correspondence, program assertions, collecting biometric information, not only on the suspected persons, what happens to the principle of non-discrimination? Many states have adopted also a variety of investigative techniques to identify terrorist suspects or to protect them from entering their territory. These techniques include the use of highly fixed mass protection or decision that targets foreign citizens, refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, or Muslims, and the result will associate these people with terrorism and stigmatize, which is forbidden according to the ICCPR and the Foreign Conventions. All such investigations should be reviewed and subject to scrutiny by competent domestic and international bodies. I may conclude saying that while confronting the threat of terrorism, states need to undertake effective counter-terrorism measures that respect the rule of law and international legal obligations. Also, states should begin the process of legislating on this law and negotiating with international states can be drafted to assess the violation of national human rights law that are frequently implicated by a global war on terrorism. fiction laws and information should be drafted to complementary reference sources of national human rights law. And along there, this has to make human rights and directly contribute to the effectiveness of inactive contact in the future. Thank you very much, Josh.
Great moment, because the culture said that during the war, the laws were silent. Unfortunately, that's not quite true. The laws have spoken, and an enormous number of laws passed that have been part of our problem. What has been silent to some extent are fundamental principles of the group. The committee's against them for this has been feared. That the news of some magazine and this is why supermarket which had received yesterday in the Washington Post in the Western lines. He focuses on the misuse of the phrase war on terror. I think that's been the first word. It's not a war, it's a struggle. This consequence so far on terror did accomplish one major objective. It stipulated the emergence of a culture of fear. Fear obscures reason, intensifies emotions, makes it easier for demagogic competitions to mobilize the public on behalf of the policies they want to pursue. And this happened to some extent in this country. Some commit to call the various orange alerts. One of those before 2004 has been one of my notes since 2004. Somehow we are less safe now for our country. Now, what happens in American history, such fears are not enough. Throughout our history, starting from our early days, with the building of wars and denying the day of the Civil War, Civil War, World War I, World War II, the McCarthy period, the Vietnam period, but yet again, in the name of fear, out of fear of what was happening, of other Western Americans, and others, primarily Americans during these times, have to travel. Some of the things I'm going to talk about, involving the FBI and other government agencies, are not really that new. It happened before, obviously. And for a while we learned, I don't think I agree with what was said about a reassessment going on. I don't think it's a reassessment going on now. I think what's been happening is that the revelation of some terrible abuses that have taken place involving Americans, by the FBI, by the NSA, and by others. And these were not known, these were seen. And had been in all of the allowance, of course, they didn't have to be possible by taking that against my positions. I think we might find a different situation. The most prominent law that was passed was, of course, that was mentioned in the Patriot Act. I think that the Patriot Act is, in some respects, hard to do, because basically what it did is it increased by exponential figure enormously the surveillance of Americans. But it's the secret surveillance of Americans. And we really don't know very much about the consequences of this. We do know, for example, a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago, it was revealed by the Inspector General, which means internally generated within the Justice Department, that's 20,000 letters, national security letters. These are letters issued by the FBI in which, without going to a poll, they get access to private information and records of all kinds. And they're supposed to be certain preconditions. It turns out that yet again, in intensive vessels, these preconditions are not met. The consequences were, again, we don't know. We don't know that these abuses have taken place. And that's not new. We know, for example, that during the Vietnam War, the FBI did a lot of things like in 1975, after the result first year by accident, mostly by accident, about selling. Why does that happen again? You know, the next week I'm looking at the other conditions for why that it's not a typical situation, it's a great deal. There have been all between seeking intelligence and criminal investigation. That was broken down. And we don't know how much of the standard for intelligence has been used in criminal investigation, where some folks have been much higher. But we do know because of several years of reports of things and because of the New York Times, we do know that in violation of the law, there have been wiretapping without any warrant, without any judicial authority whatsoever, on the telephone of these men, communications, and so on, of Americans, purely domestic couples. And that is paid to be illegal, without question, it is illegal. Again, not so much reassessment, but it is pointing out that some things that have been forbidden could possibly be violated. And this also was not known. That special court that issued wiretaps on the courts about 4 years ago in something in a case that somehow, for the reason that the fourth year was published, the report that in some 75 instances the FBI had misrepresented facts, and that was a lot in order to get wireless when wires were required. Again, something that's been revealed. Now, perhaps the worst facet of all of this is the corruption of the rule of law. Because all of this has been defended in the name of an interpretation of the law. Article 2 of the Constitution, the rest of the authority as commander-in-chief. I think the great justice years ago said, the president is not the commander-in-chief of the American people, but the commander-in-chief of the army. Well, this president has acted as if he's the commander-in-chief of the American people, and that there's very little that he can do. That is forbidden. That's not because of time once, that's forbidden. And in fact, it's not clear that there's anything, because one of the legal panels, and here's where we get the corruption of the profession, of lawyers and government. One of the legal memos by the Assistant Attorney General, who is in that office as supposed to be the law, the one that advises the president of the law, supposed to bring the lawsuits on things. The Assistant Attorney General now sits on one of the courts in the United States, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And he wrote that there is no law, domestic law, constitution, or federal law, tell the president what to do with the time or before time. And we're able to say to you before that, in the rule of law, of course. But it's not just the federal government. The magazine yesterday, so the New York Times, or the day before, the fact that we also have state and local security apparatus. And they have also done tremendous amount of surveillance in connection with the Republican National Convention. They infiltrated a huge number of groups. But it turned out, from various lawsuits, it's turned out that the overwhelming number of them were peaceful groups that don't intend to destroy in any way whatsoever. And the New York City Police Department knew that that was the case. Exchange this information with police to the FBI. And so they have files on all of these people. Now, that's what's happening domestically with respect to Americans. They casually, they're doing right from the very beginning, actually, probably November, December 2001, but certainly by January 2002, the president's advisors were telling him that the Geneva Convention, the works of the current Attorney General, the Geneva Conventions were obsolete and in some respects quaint.
And so the protection of the State Department and I would guess a fair number of military lawyers, the president said, well, we're not going to take action to the Geneva Convention. What do three people have you made? Well, the president said the decision to be made is not that most people would share, as we can see from in this panel. And so a whole series of memos were prepared to justify everything that was done. The president and the administration, of course, said we don't torture, but they defied torture in such a way that they can do anything they want. And of course, have adopted measures and interrogation techniques that probably the world outside the United States, but the United States itself, and even the reports by the State Department on human rights, in various other contexts, they've done the interrogation techniques that are considered torture by any humane person. One thing that shows the complete contempt for law here that was involved is that there is one threat running through all of the government's activities, and that is to keep it away from the courts. Now, the past courts have not been terribly difficult to deal with. Some of the courts have not been able to determine this. Somehow this point is different. Somehow the administration moves to the court. And I think the reason they do it is because of the breathtaking sweep of its claims. In fact, it's one of the predictable. Of course, some judges, in the Fourth Circuit, which covers this area from Maryland, South Carolina, I think, were pretty much willing to give the government anything it wanted, although even they refused that the government's claim that courts had no business, zero, to deal with these issues. They said, yes, we do. We can't take away from us what we believe in unlawful justice, which means in practice, where we want to get, which is what they did. When it comes to the Supreme Court, at least three times, the Supreme Court said, government, you want to I was the court for two of those cases, and I can take a fair shot in the sweep of the government's claim of what they did. But the court does not want confrontations with the executive in the time of the war. And therefore, except for one case, the case of Guantanamo, and even there, perhaps, all the cases were put in terms of statutory which was the Defense Department that decided to apply one form or another to Nazis. They were statutory. That means Congress can overturn it. And of course, quickly did. And our checks and balances system has pretty much, until recently, collapsed. Certainly the congressional side. And except in these rare cases, the judicial side, because most judges were quite willing to give the government what they wanted at the local levels. Something the Supreme Court had encouraged judges to do there, who protested against what was happening. And so Congress trying to first Congress has the detention treatment act. The essence of that act, the primary purpose of that act, was to respond to criticisms of what was happening by the only two senators, the only two members of Congress who might have any power. Because during 6 years, Congress control the same party as the president, all the members of that party, perhaps unwilling to challenge their own president in the time of war, if they saw, perhaps unwilling to challenge the president of everything, did the greatest single question. Only two people did, Senator McCain and Graham, and they complained about what they saw as torture. So they put something into an act, but at the same time, wrote a provision that tries to have the courts from doing anything message from the president. At the summit, it says, I take all my constitutional powers, which many are concerned. I'm going to keep doing exactly what I want to do, and I will continue to do so. So this is the technique we have to think about. In June 2006, the Supreme Court struck down the kind of funding of a military commission for war crimes, insisted on the applicability of the Geneva Conventions as a matter of sentence of the law again. And the administration went back to its friends in Congress, and a couple of the members of Congress said, at the end of the day, they gave the president just about every single one, including asking the courts absolutely completely wrong. Now, that last provision was dealt with in this conversation. Very sweet for the Senate, 50 before the end. We have no Senate, 6 seats change hands. We have the House of Representatives, where you know. Yep, the tar is not with the top off, and we get something for the catalog. So I guess it's the same as for this, which is the time to do last time, restoring a historical system, we're not going to be restored this time. What are the consequences of this? The United States has lost its moral center. That's not just the problem for the United States. It's a problem for the whole world. Because the United States has been honest. The United States is exposed as a hypocrite. But you know what happens when I was shut down by the question stops. And I think whatever we try to do with our human rights reports and the rest, I remember the human rights report came out in 2005 after this. The Russian Minister of Software said, they're telling us about human rights. This is a person I have to put up. There's a human rights process, not something else. There is no aggression on freedom of speech. There has been opposition continually to what the government has done. There has been great discrimination against Muslims. But I think it's fair to say that if most of it has been open, most of it has been private speech, the private people. There has been suppression of the government, it's true. There have been democracies as well. But at the same time, the first member of Congress is a Muslim, has been elected, and when one alien from Virginia, from the Secretary of the Constitution, came to also on the Quran, there was such an outcry that immediately apologized and said that I was misinterpreted. As the president, the number two that the government has said, we must remember that there should be no intolerance for Muslims and others who are what is the truth, but they must pick up. One of the most harming aspects of this, and I'll go through this because I run it goes on a positive note. One of the most harming aspects of this has been the action of the press in the last 2 years. It's fair to say that much of the press role that I've taken in the first 3 or 4 years has changed. It's changed rapidly. And it's only because we have a free and truly generous press that the NSA wiretapping has been revealed, that a raid was revealed, that the mission of the NSA was revealed, what's happened to people this weekend and how it was revealed. Much of the things that have happened, and they have, during this period, I think, has been the result of America's devotion. Despite the hostility of the administration, and I would say vigorous progressive press, I think America now, not only early years, except
have a dialogue, I encourage you also to not be shy and put the questions in the chat box. Also, if you have brief comments, maybe you would like to look at this a bit further. Of course, the work can also be into that as well. So, I want to take comments. Already.
I was wondering if I could use this for this point about it's sort of, I forgot the word that you used, like a reassessment, and that's what's allowing the discussion to now focus on human rights versus the security that was talked about a lot right after the September 11th attacks. And I would have to say, I always thought of it, fear was so much more immediate that it stomped out the dissent and demonized it as unpatriotic and un-American to have the discussion about civil liberties because it was us versus them. And as the fear becomes more distant and less immediate because of exposing either corruption in Iraq or failed policies in Afghanistan or what have you, as that fear sort of becomes more distant, further away, that's why we're having the discussion on human rights. It's not that we're reassessing anything, but now there's room for that discussion because everything that was justifying the fear before is now dwindling away. Do you agree with that, or?
Well, I would say that the fear is moving away. I would say that we're also doing your experience in fear 24/7. Eventually, you get to address and see other things that maybe you were not seeing before. In terms of the general fear concept, I will propose to you: do you think that the picture would have been active or not 9/11. The picture the only rationale that it took second first of life, and Professor Crowley will have more to say about that, is that that didn't change the things at all when it was first used. That easily switched it. It didn't have any sort of support until September, and then I disagree with you about the actions
even what the Patriot Act was passed, there was a lot of discussions. But it was 6 weeks after September 11th. The bill, I think, was 642 pages long. So we could possibly read it. And I can tell you, if you read it in 4 pages, you'll go crazy. Because what it does is it has 3 words here, 6 words there, X plus X here. It basically amends its existing legislation. But it transforms things by 3 words here and 6 words there. And that makes a little difference. No matter what it does, you've got to have a book there. I think this is one time when one crisis where the dissent was not a problem.
Yeah, I have two questions, and they are related to the future. In the domestic realm, this has happened in a way similar that happened in the past. And in the past, we wanted this not to happen. So if we don't want this to happen in the future, is there any things we can do about that? And the second question is related to the international realm. One of my main concerns is how the image of the United States has decreased in the human rights arena because of all this. So there is the vacuum. And what happened with the vacuum? Is the European system going to fill it? Is it going to be a time where nobody can take the lead role? What do you think?
We've asked two huge questions. There's no speech. I got the impression talking to people up there when I have the State Department as a private expert to speak to the government. I got the impression that this book is headed up the administration. Personally, I was thinking that I would have warmly welcomed everywhere, even by those who were really very harsh. I spoke with bar associations in law schools, my young people who were very accurate, who were in law school, young people who were quickly expressed. So I think that with the change in administration, with the creation of what has gone on, I put out on the creation saying this was terrible and it was not happening, it may be possible to repair something. I'm looking from the inside out.
The second question, because the role of the United States in the human rights, as a human rights advocate, has been hurt and somehow diminished by what is happening, it seems to be, if there is a lobby, who is the leader, an advocate for the world on human rights, and how do you see the role of the United States in this situation, and if someone else, if it's possible that someone else, like the European, just can, kind of, I wouldn't say take over, but, you know, have a more prominent or visible role.
So a lot of them, the United States is very human rights to act universally, unilaterally. Also, the same thing applies to terrorism. As we know, there is so many reasons for terrorism across the globe, from poverty to discrimination to occupation. We all agree that no just cause or no rituals is more important than human lives. One thing here I would like to add is unilateral actions are very damaging. When we, as the professor mentioned, lose moral credibility. Also, I would like to say that we have like an arsenal of laws fighting terrorism, to fight terrorism and to fight human rights violations, but we don't have like a global policy that would take like the two and have like a very clear mechanism to work on both issues. Thank you.
Yeah, I have more of a comment than a question, but somebody may want to respond to it. After 9/11, there was a feeling that we needed to do something to make it safer. And my concern is that we did a lot of things that I kind of call feel-good security, where we, such as you mentioned the you can get your train ticket at the machine, but if you go to the ticket window, you've got to show an ID. And in my own mind, I view basically a three-part test to restrictions and liberty and so forth as to whether it's appropriate in the balance between liberty and security. And the three-part test that I have is, first, is the restriction reasonably designed to accomplish the purpose for which it's being imposed? And there you have your ticket issue. I have the one I like to point to is it's not so much a law practice going into the National Gallery of Art. My wife's bag is searched. But, and don't tell them this, but my raincoat has awful large pockets, and they are not searched. So, you know, that's an example of, you know, the restriction, although it's minor, is my wife's bag being searched. It doesn't really accomplish anything. The second part of the test is the restriction the least restrictive restriction that can be used to accomplish that goal. And final part is there should be some sort of due process involved to appeal or whatever. And again, that due process should be limited only based on reasonableness and being a least restriction on due process. And it seems to me that a lot of the Patriot Act and other acts and that have come since seem to be kind of, in some parts, flailing in the wind, trying to look like they're doing something but not doing something, or they are overreaching, trying to accomplish things by imposing excessive restrictions.
Before I say another question, I just wanted to maybe ask an indulgence for a couple of minutes, because there are two issues that have been in the news recently that I think are worth touching as part of this conversation. The first is on the issue of Dahl, and I think what was suffering from probably the Mexico's largest human rights disaster today. And the reason I bring Dahl to us very briefly is because we think about this and possibly someone else's reaction on the panel if we're going to look at it. A number of different individuals and so to speak the rights of the LA Times. John Brent Castor's press group noted that while the United States has been very strong rhetorically criticized critiquing probably the Sudanese government for all their actions in Darfur, it's led to some 400,000 deaths in Sudan. It's very little of real action, and the point put forward by the Gaza and Silver Sea is that this may not simply just be a byproduct of single focus on what's coming from Iran, but may in fact have something to do with the relationship between the ex-Sudanese intelligence, Saudi Ghosh, and CIA. Saudi Ghosh was flown over in 2005, and it was the but more recently, when NBC reporter and crew were in Khartoum, and they met the judiciary government. They was like, oh, I'm right, but yes, we do have close cooperation with the U.S. So I think that's something for us to think about and consider on the real task process of the choice for you. Trust if you're going to be down or against the Wi-Fi. Second issue, what's that? I think it's the force of my own. Is in the back here. And those of you who made it involved both primarily that. You see what the recently has been. We have seen a lot of huge reports coming out of Zimbabwe where the government has lashed out and out of themselves in the front of the president's position leaders, rights organizations. It's just something to think about in the context of Zimbabwe. A couple of years when I was there, I together a report came back to the U.S. and had some meetings with. Comes to the State Department and said, look, on this issue, we're with you. No organization to vote for is causing the criticism. So we want to do something more. Which, frankly, because of our policies out there, I love in particular, the Iran Foundation was really triggered out at that time. Hopefully, we talked about it, and I think that we saw firsthand how effectively the President of the House of Mahat managed to create it. Black and black, which is the local versus global south, where it's far away, and by a front has all of them, six business town levels, those exclusions, we mock on second business. In the end, I think one more question.
Yes,
because I think the very poor example is one of the four close examples of the spectrum stuff.
Thank you.
Trump's application. Presentation. Send some spending for the chef before the RCC. But probably Sudan is not a member of this region. such as America, Natural Resources, mentioned this region, such as Israel did the same thing. So spending people before the ICCC, but from a state which is not a member of this region, violating the principle of legality in the international law. And give a chance to people in this area, I don't know about the how the international community deals with problems when this problem happens in specific countries and does not apply the same standard when this problem happens in another country.
Before we have a response, and then I do want to have a couple more questions from the audience. The United States, even if the United States of course relies on the policy of the international criminal law, they don't decide to do that. Yeah, but they work right on policies. This U.S. Security Council has the ability to refer to the ICC. Maybe probably the closest equivalent to the correct of this is the matter which the Security Council has ad hoc tribunals for the public side of our powerful the closer analogy to some sort of what they did in Sudan and the Darfur things that support that power of the let's take maybe one final question from the audience. Question comments.
May I ask about like therefore situation and the cooperation between Sudanese intelligence and the U.S. government? One of very few like Sudanese officials who get like red carpet treatment in the U.S. intelligence and, because of like valuable information by the about Al-Qaeda in particular, because they were in Sudan actually in 1990, from 1995, I think, till 1998. And as valuable as the information was, the cost was very high in terms of the U.S. government had to, like, first of all, endorse some, not officially, of course, some of the grave like human rights violations that were committed by the government of Sudan. And the issue also will bring back like the importance of like global policy for combating both terrorism and human rights violations.
I think I want to be the last one. Thank you very much.